From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There are many, many things on President-elect Joe Biden's plate in the weeks after winning re-election, among them repairing the U.S.'s relationship to the rest of the world. President Donald Trump has cozied up to dictators, and unsurprisingly, they are among those world leaders who have not congratulated Biden yet. Will Biden take the U.S. back to the years of Obama's foreign policy, where relations with nations like China, Russia, and North Korea were hostile? Will he be able to repair relations with Iran that had signed a historic nuclear pact with Obama? Will he constructively address violence and war in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, or Yemen? Will he remain as friendly with Israel's apartheid state as Trump was, or pull back slightly as Obama did? Joining me to help answer those questions is Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you, Sonali. I'm happy to be here.
So the world watched as the U.S. presidential elections unfolded, and it seemed as though the world, most of the world, also celebrated, as did most, or as did a majority of Americans, I should say. Did you get that sense that there was so much depending internationally, globally, on the U.S. election?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly friends of mine who live in other countries communicated that this election was not only about what happens in the United States, but what happens all over the world. So it makes perfect sense to me that the similar relief and all kinds of emotions, really, that we have seen in this country would be shared by others around the world. Though, truthfully, there's reason to have mixed feelings, and I think that we're seeing all kinds of responses. But however you slice it, what happens here has tremendous impact all over the world. So I think it's really important as we talk about what it means that Trump lost this election, that Biden won, that we talk about not only what that means domestically, but what that means internationally.
How much of a blow is Trump's loss to the dictators that he cozied up to? I mean, we've seen notable silence from Vladimir Putin in Russia, from also Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil.
Right. It's a great question. And, you know, of course, we will have to wait to see exactly how this plays out. But it's worth noting that a few years ago, it felt like all around the world, the wind was in the sails of these authoritarians, whether we're talking about Trump, of course, who was leading the way, but also Israel's Netanyahu, Brazil's Bolsonaro. Then we had, of course, Putin in Russia, like you said, Duterte in the Philippines, Boris Johnson in Britain. I mean, it was the far right was not only on the march, but authoritarians were winning power and exercising it. And, you know, really, there's been a number of setbacks for a lot of them. And truthfully, the pandemic has had a lot to do with that. I mean, certainly, it's worth noting that the countries with the highest rates, certainly the United States still has the highest death toll, and Brazil is right behind it. Britain, I'm not sure where it's at today, but Britain has suffered tremendously under Boris Johnson's helm.
Although Johnson did congratulate Biden, and as one of the early sort of people to succumb to COVID-19 seemed to have been chastened a little bit. And to your point about the coronavirus pandemic weakening the power of dictators, certainly this is a kind of enemy, if you will, quote unquote, that requires international cooperation, collectivism, government support, all of the things that the authoritarians of the world have fought against. And so it's been an interestingly timed disaster.
Exactly. I mean, that kind of nationalism has just been catastrophic for so many reasons. And I forgot in the list of authoritarians, I forgot to name India's Modi as well. You know, this kind of racist nationalist violence that we've seen from the United States to India, to Brazil, to Hungary, has been devastating, but I do think you're right that the pandemic has put a finer point on just how destructive it is for the entire world's population. I mean, of course, the most vulnerable have been suffering. People like migrants, people like marginalized communities in all of these places. But the not only lack of cooperation regarding the pandemic, but the hostility to international cooperation has been devastating for the spread of the virus.
Let's take a look at the damage that Trump has done in the realm of foreign policy over these four long years. I mean, we can only touch on the surface of it because it runs so deep and we could spend many, many days talking about it, specifically on the issue of Iran. That was one of the few bright spots in foreign policy of the Obama administration. And Trump came in guns blazing on Iran, brought in people like John Bolton and others who had centered hostility to Iran in their careers. And it seems as though he pretty much undid the hard work of the Obama administration on the Iran nuclear peace pact, right?
Right. I mean, men like John Bolton's life's work is to invade Iran. He is single-mindedly focused on advancing the interests of U.S. empire in as violent a way as possible. And he has a particular axe to grind with Iran. And these were the kinds of people who Trump elevated under his tenure. And so when it comes to the Iran nuclear deal, which, you know, this is a deal that was negotiated in an asymmetrical way, of course. Who is regulating the United States' possession and manufacture of nuclear weapons, right? There are major problems with the deal, and yet Iran was cooperating with it, and the Trump administration essentially said, well, we won't take yes for an answer. We're going to renegotiate this anyway. And the sanctions on Iran have been devastating. And again, even more so in light of the pandemic, where it's a situation where Iranians are not able to access pharmaceuticals or pharmaceutical agents that are necessary to deal with COVID-19, as well as any number of other medical supplies, medical equipment. Mm-hmm. So this has been absolutely catastrophic for the people of Iran in particular.
Is the Iranian leadership, you think, hopeful that Biden, under a Biden presidency, there will be some restoration of relations between the two countries that would really benefit Iran? Or has Trump done so much damage that relationship is frayed?
It's a good question. I mean, no doubt the damage that has been wrought by the Trump administration will be lasting all around the world and for any number of countries, and Iran in particular. I mean, we think about just the past year that Iran has experienced with Trump as the president of the United States, a year that opened with the assassination of an Iranian general on Iraqi soil, and then went from there. So there's really a kind of damage here that is very severe. And at the same time, Biden has signaled his support for the Iran nuclear deal and his interest in returning to that. And, you know, I think that this is true in general. It remains to be seen, of course, what a Biden administration would actually do. But there is a break here. There is a transition. And in that transition, there is an opportunity. So no doubt Iranians are taking note of that.
There's Russia as well and China. These are two nations that, of course, are formidable economies, have had a sort of, you know, frenemy relationship with the U.S., for lack of a more formal term. The Obama administration had been, you know, alternatively hostile but friendly, especially with China. With Russia, it was pretty hostile. In comes Trump, and he goes back and forth with China, you know, on the friendliness versus hostility. On Russia, he basically has been quite friendly, relatively speaking, in terms of verbal overtures. When it comes to actual relations, it's been similar to Obama. What do you think Biden will do with Russia and China. During the debates, we heard a lot of hostility toward China. Trump and Biden were trying to outdo each other on China and on being hostile to China.
That's right. I mean, there's really, well, let me say a word about Russia first, because I think that what you said is really important. Trump rhetorically has been very friendly with Putin, and that's, you know, rhetoric goes a long way when Trump supports the words of Putin in favor of his own intelligence agencies, you know, which he has done. So I don't mean to minimize it to just be rhetoric, but as you said, in practice, what the United States has done under Trump is actually, for example, put more weapons and up the amount of military funding in Europe that is directed at Russia, right? So there's what Trump says rhetorically, and then in reality, or what in practice, in action, what the United States has been doing and what Trump has continued is escalating militarization against Russia. And that is absolutely the case for China, where there is no, you know, both rhetorically and in action, it's just hostility. And that really, you know, it is the case that hostility to China really occupied an important place in this current election, but it isn't just this current election. For years now, for successive administrations, at least going back to the George W. Bush administration, their kind of denouncing China was a centerpiece of the U.S. State of the Union address. There's China bashing is a feature of rhetoric and policy from the White House, even as you say, the U.S. and Chinese economies are so integrated that they're, which lends itself to a certain amount of cooperation. I think that's the frenemy dynamic, but it is increasingly look more like enemies. So what exactly will happen? Unfortunately, signs point to a continued escalation of tensions and militarization, actually. You know, the outgoing, now outgoing Secretary of Defense Esper was recently with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo touring Asia to shore up relationships with various Asian states, which includes more intelligence sharing and other military cooperation, as well as U.S. weapons sales to various U.S. Allies in Asia. That is all directed at China. But that didn't start with Trump. That actually goes back, again, at least to the Obama administration. Actually, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton herself did extensive touring of Asia to shore up relationships with U.S. allies, which involve arming them against China. So the militarization is something that has been consistent across administrations. And unfortunately, Biden is signaling that kind of hostility in identifying China as an enemy is something that he wants to continue to do.
Right. And we are now hearing reports that he is considering Michelle Flournoy as Secretary of Defense. Of course, this coming on the same day that President Trump has simply fired his Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, and put in place Christopher Miller, head of the counterterrorism unit. And progressives are calling out the fact that Michelle Flournoy, who is a potential pick for Secretary of Defense under Biden, is very hawkish. And instead asking for people like Senator Chris Murphy, who sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and who has a more progressive foreign policy outlook, to be Biden's pick instead. Certainly, who Biden picks as Secretary of Defense sends a signal to the world, right?
Absolutely. And truthfully, though, I think that hostility to China runs very deep in Washington. And I think that it's really going to require a challenge from progressive movements in this country and all around the world to confront that. You know, it's true that the question of personnel absolutely sends a signal, but this goes so far beyond personnel. I mean, there is a bipartisan embrace of the notion that China is this threat to the United States. And it really, we've got to shift away from that whole way of thinking. I am concerned, actually, given the the constant talk and the reality of political division in this country and division between the two parties in Washington, that one thing that they can agree on and unite on is their hostility to China. And I'm concerned that that will be put forward by different elected officials as well. We may not agree on the question of, healthcare or Social Security or the Green New Deal, but we can all unite when it comes to opposing China and confronting it as its threat. And that's something that is extremely troubling, I think, that we've got to challenge.
And that was a little bit what the U.S.'s relationship with North Korea had been pre-Trump. And there was one bright spot, if there was one bright spot in foreign policy during the Trump administration, it was that we came close to diplomatic relations with North Korea. And then, honestly, I'm not even sure what happened. But unfortunately, do you worry that the Biden administration will go back to the Obama posturing with bipartisan support of constantly being hostile to North Korea to the detriment of the people of that nation?
Right. Well, there's a number of things to consider here. The reason to be cautious and to be concerned is absolutely there, and I certainly have it. And it's not only because of what we saw under Obama and Biden toward the in terms of policy toward the Korean Peninsula. It's also the fact that when Trump, Trump, it should be said that Trump zigzagged on the question of North Korea, right? There were times when he said, I will annihilate you. And there are other times when he said, Kim is a great guy and we can make a deal. So,
right. Rocket Man was one legacy of Trump.
Exactly. This kind of racist anti-Asian caricatures of Kim with, and mocking him as Little Rocket Man and all of this. So that is also, that's a key part of Trump's legacy when it comes to the Korean Peninsula, even though he likes to think of himself as a deal maker and a peacemaker. But that said, in the moments where Trump was saying, you know what, maybe we can agree with North Korea's demands on reducing a U.S. troop presence, it was actually congressional Democrats who opposed that. It was actually congressional Democrats who said, no, we have to maintain the U.S. Troop presence in South Korea,
right.
who opposed a kind of demilitarization. So there is real reason to be concerned. What's good is that there's a number of factors here, including a very significant and inspiring movement in South Korea of South Korean activists who are opposed to the U.S. military presence, who are opposed to this missile system that the U.S. has deployed to South Korea, and continue to protest at U.S. bases and conduct mass direct action against U.S. militarization there. So that's another factor. And I think that it'll be really important to highlight that kind of people's resistance that also exists on the Korean Peninsula and throughout Asia, actually, to U.S. militarization.
Elsewhere in Asia, and Central Asia in particular, you still have the war on Afghanistan. Although the U.S. signed a peace deal with the Taliban, we are seeing very serious violence continue to break out, most recently with the terrible bombing at Kabul University that killed dozens of students. The violence there continues, even, as the world's attention moves away from Afghanistan. We have Syria. We still have the war in Yemen, in that Middle East region, and of course, Iraq. What do you expect Biden to do? What can he do, considering that in many of those countries, there is a legacy that even goes beyond Trump, but is still laid at the U.S.'s feet of fomenting violence and pouring in arms? There's a U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel in the mix of that, too, and Turkey.
Right, exactly. Well, and go
and
down
Russia
the line.
And
in Egypt and Jordan and in Qatar and the UAE. So in terms of what the U.S. could do under Biden, what it should do. There's a long, long list of things.
Right, what it could do and what it should do, unfortunately, are separate things.
Right. Yeah, and then there's what it will do. Yeah. And so, just to start with, maybe we can start with what Biden has been signaling, which is, on one hand, there are some good things. Biden has said that he wants to stop U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, which of course is long overdue. That would be a very significant thing. Biden has said that he has not only said this as a candidate, but he held this policy when he was vice president in the Obama administration, that he favors less the large-scale occupying U.S. kind of military forces and more the special forces counterterrorism operations. Now, it's important to examine that because, you know, those counterterrorism operations, while they may do something to preserve the lives of U.S. military personnel, they have been catastrophic for the people of Yemen, for the people of Afghanistan, for the people of Somalia, and unfortunately, many other places. So, you know, if Biden follows through on ending U.S. support for Saudi Arabia, that would be very good. I hope that it happens. It's good that he's signaled it, but it's worth noting that actually when Obama came in to office, he also said that he would do some, he said that he would close Guantanamo Bay. That didn't happen. He said that he would end the U.S. presence in Iraq. That did not happen. So, you know, it's good that he's saying it, that Biden's saying it. We should be cautiously hopeful about the good things, but very concerned about the things that he is also saying. Now, in terms of what could actually be done and what should be done, you know, and again, there's a long list of things not only to stop the harm that's being perpetrated by U.S. forces at this moment, but to undo the damage that U.S. empire has caused the world over. But things that could immediately be done and should immediately be done. Yes, of course, not only should the U.S. stop supporting Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, but actually the U.S. should stop its own forces that are also operating in Yemen. It isn't just Saudi Arabia, it's U.S. forces as well. The U.S. should immediately suspend all military aid and military cooperation with Saudi Arabia and do that with any number of other countries. The U.S. should immediately suspend its operations in places like Somalia, in Afghanistan. You know, the catastrophic violence that you were just describing, casualties are going up. And casualties in Afghanistan, these are coming from U.S. attacks and from the U.S. allied Afghan forces. And so that kind of thing has to stop as well, along with a whole host of other things, of course.
Corey, we could do a whole show on the U.S. relationship with Israel and where Biden will fall on that, as well as Latin America. We will be covering those issues in separate interviews. I want to thank you so much for joining us and spending this time with us.
It's always a pleasure, Sonali. This conversation is so important, so I'm glad that we're having it.
My guest has been Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we've been discussing President-elect Joe Biden's potential foreign policy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.